Let me ask him a question,
said Monkey.
Old man, have you a considerable amount of property?
I have 40 or 50 acres of paddy,
said he.
60 or 70 acres of dry field, and 80 or 90 pasture fields. Then I have 200 or 300 water buffaloes, some 30 horses and mules, and any number of pigs, sheep, chickens, and geese. I have more grain in my barns than we can get through, and more silk in my stores than we can wear. And about the house, we have everything we could possibly need.
If you are as well off as that, said Monkey,
it's a pity you are so economical.
Why do you call me economical?
Said the old man.
If you are as well off as this,
said Monkey,
I cannot understand why you allow your daughter and nephew to be sacrificed. By spending 50 pieces of silver, you could buy a girl, and for 100 pieces you could buy a boy. Would not this be better than losing your own posterity?
You do not understand,
said the old man.
This god is not so easy to deceive. He often comes to the village and goes about amongst us.
Then you must know what he looks like,
said Monkey.
We don't see him,
said he.
We only smell the strangely scented wind. That is how we know that he has come. We hasten to burn great quantities of incense, and all of us, young and old, bow down towards this wind. The god knows everything that goes on here, even the exact date at which each of us was born. He would not accept any child that was not ours, let alone 200 pieces of silver. Not even 1,000 or 10,000 pieces could buy 2 children of exactly the same appearance and age.
That is true,
said Monkey.
But all the same, I should very much like to have a look at this boy of yours.
Chien Ching, the old man's brother, hurried in, and bringing out the child War Boy in his arms, set him down in the lamplight. Knowing nothing of the terrible fate that was in store for it, the child capered about, munching some fruit that it had brought tucked into its wide sleeves. Monkey, after having a look at it, murmured a spell, shook himself, and changed into an exact counterpart of War Boy. The two children joined hands and capered together in the lamplight. The father, in his astonishment at the miracle, flung himself upon his knees.
We are not worthy, said Tripitaka. Pray rise.
A moment ago I was talking to him,
said the old man,
and now he has suddenly become the exact image of my child. When I call, both come running up. Oh, this is more than I can bear. Pray go back to your usual form.
Monkey rubbed his cheek, and in a moment had resumed his proper shape.
Father,
said the old man,
never would I have believed that such a miracle was possible.
Was I like your child?
Asked Monkey.
Like,
said the old man.
I should think you were. Face, voice, height, everything was right.
And weight, too,
said Monkey,
as you would have found if you had tested us with the scales.
No doubt, no doubt,
cried the old man.
In weight, too!
Do you think I should have been accepted for sacrifice? Asked Monkey.
I don't doubt it,
said the old man.
Of course you would be accepted.
I'm going to save this child's life, that you may have posterity to burn incense to your soul in time to come. I am ready to be sacrificed to the great king.
Father,
said the old man,
if you indeed perform this act of compassion, I will give your master 1,000 pieces of silver to provide for his further journey to the west.
And you won't give anything to me?
Asked Monkey.
But you'll have been sacrificed,
said he.
You won't be there to receive it.
How do you mean I shan't be there?
Said Monkey.
The god will have eaten you,
said the old man.
Do you think he'd dare?
Said Monkey.
If he doesn't eat you,
said the old man,
it will only be because you smell worse than I believe.
Heaven's will be done,
said Monkey.
If he eats me, that proves I was meant to die young. If he doesn't eat me, that's my luck. Anyway, you may sacrifice me.
Chien Ching poured out suitable thanks and added another 500 pieces of silver to the sum he promised. Meanwhile, his brother did not utter a word, but leant against the door, weeping bitterly.
I fear you are worrying about your daughter, said Monkey, coming up to him.
Father,
said the old man, kneeling in front of him,
I cannot part with her. It is something that my nephew is to be saved, but I have no other child, and if she is taken from me, who will there be to howl at my funeral? How can I give her up?
Go at once and steam another 5 pecks of rice and prepare some good vegetables. That's the way to win that long-snouted priest's heart. He will be only too glad to change himself into your girl or anything else you ask him. Then we'll both go and be sacrificed together.
Brother, said Pigsy, horrified at this suggestion, you comply with your own life as you please, but you have no right to drag me into the adventure.
Brother,
said Monkey,
the proverb says, even a chicken must work for its food.
We have both had a sumptuous feast. Instead of complaining that you haven't been given enough, you ought to be ready to do what you can for these people in their little trouble.
I'm no good at transformations,
said Pigsy.
Nonsense,
said Monkey.
You have 36 transformations.
Pigsy, said Trippy Tartar,
he's perfectly right. To save one life is better than building a 7-storied pagoda.
You ought to show your gratitude, and you would be accumulating secret merit into the bargain. You have nothing better to do tonight, and have no excuse for not going with your brother.
You don't know what you're saying, Master, said Pigsy. I can change into a mountain, a tree, a scabby elephant, a water buffalo, or a pot-bellied rogue. But changing into a small girl is a much more difficult matter.
Don't believe him,
said Monkey,
but bring out your child.
Chien hurried into the house and came out carrying the child load of gold. With him came his wife and concubine and all the household, banging their heads on the floor and imploring Pigsy to save the child. The little girl was wearing an emerald fillet with pearl pendants, a red hemp-thread bodice shot with yellow, a green satin coat with a chessboard patterned collar, a plum-blossom red silk skirt, toad's head patterned pink hemp-thread shoes, and gold-kneed raw silk drawers. She, like her cousin, was nibbling at a piece of fruit.
Here's the girl, Pigsy,
said Monkey.
Change quickly into a replica of her, and we'll go off and be sacrificed.
How am I to look as smart as that?
Said Pigsy.
Make haste,
said Monkey,
or you'll feel my cudgel.
The fool wagged his head, muttered a spell, and said,
Change.
His head began to change, and soon became indistinguishable from that of the child. But his big belly remained just the same, and quite spoilt the resemblance.
Go on,
cried Monkey, laughing.
You may beat me, Blue, said Pigsy, but I swear I can't change any further. What's to be done?
You can't stay like that with a girl's head in a priest's belly,
said Monkey.
You're neither a man nor a woman. It's a bad mess. I must see what I can do with you.
He blew upon Pigsy with magic breath, and immediately the change was completed, and he became exactly like the child from head to foot.
To avoid any mistake, you'd better take the real children away,
said Monkey.
Then we shall know where we are. Give them some more fruit, for fear they should start crying. If the great king heard them, he might come and look into it. Well, now we're both ready. But how are we served? Trust or tied? and shall we be hashed or boiled?
Look here, brother, said Pixie. It's no good trying these tricks on me. All this isn't in my line at all.
I assure you, said Mr. Chien. There's no question of trussing or anything of the sort. We use two large red lacquer dishes. We shall ask you to sit in them, and they will then be put upon two table-tops, and a couple of strong young fellows will carry each of you to the temple.
Excellent, said Monkey. Bring the dishes, and we'll take a trial trip, just to see how it goes.
The old man brought out the dishes. Monkey and Pigsy sat in them, and four young fellows lifted them on to the table-tops, and having taken the victims for a ride round the courtyard, set them down again in the front room.
If it is just a question of being carried about like that, said Pigsy, I'd be quite content to do it all night. But the idea of being carried to a temple and eaten is not so funny.
All you've got to do is watch me, said Monkey. While he's slicing me up and eating me, you can jump up and run away.
That's all right if he begins with the boy, said Pigsy. But how do we know he isn't going to begin with the girl?
They always begin with the boy, said Mr. Chien. Once or twice some plucky fellow is hidden at the back of the temple or under a table, and it was always the boy he saw eaten first.
That's luck, said Pigsy.
While they were talking, there was a great din of gongs and drums outside and the glow of many lanterns. Somebody opened the gate and cried, "Bring out the boy and girl!" The old men burst into loud weeping, while the four strong men carried the two victims away. And if you do not know whether in the end they escaped with their lives, you must listen to what is told in the next chapter. Great King, our Father, said the worshippers when all was ready, following our yearly custom, we now offer up to you a male child, war boy, and a female child, load of gold, together with a pig, a sheep, and a due portion of liquor. Grant that the winds may be temperate, that rain may fall in due season, and all our crops thrive. They then burned paper horses and returned to their homes.
I think I'll go home too, said Pigsy.
You haven't got a home, said Monkey.
I'll go to Mr. Chien's farm and have a nap, said Pigsy.
What nonsense the fool talks, said Monkey. We have promised to take on this job, and we have got to see it through.
It's you who are the fool, said Pigsy. I thought you were just having a game with him. You don't mean to say we are really going to be sacrificed?
We've got to do the thing properly, said Monkey. In any case, we must wait till the king comes to eat us, or we shall spoil a good start by a poor finish. And if the king finds no victims, he will send plagues and calamities to the village. You surely don't want that?
While they were talking, there suddenly came a great gust of wind.
That's done it, said Pigsy. Talk of the devil.
Let me do the talking, said Monkey,
and in another minute a most horrible apparition appeared at the doors of the temple, with eyes like blazing comets, tusks like the teeth of a huge saw.
Well, which family is making the sacrifice this year?
He asked, halting at the entrance.
The family of the two Chien, said Monkey, if I may make bold to reply.
The king was puzzled.
This boy speaks up uncommonly boldly,
he said to himself.
Usually, at the first asking, one gets no reply at all. At the second, the victim faints with terror, and by the time I have laid hands on him, he is already dead with fright. It is odd that this child should speak up so boldly. What are your names?
He presently asked.
I am War Boy,
said Monkey,
and the girl is called
Load of gold.
Well, war boy, and load of gold, said the monster, I must tell you that this sacrifice is a very old institution. You have been offered to me by your parents according to custom, and I am now going to eat you.
Help yourself, said Monkey. We shan't put any obstacle in your way.
On hearing this, the monster again hesitated.
Now none of your sauce,
he said.
You're too forward. I usually begin with a boy, but this time I think I'll begin with a girl instead.
Stick to your rule, great king, gasped Pigsy. It's always a pity when old customs disappear.
But the monster was not in the mood to start a discussion, and striding forward he grabbed at Pigsy. That fool leapt off the dish, changed into his proper form, and seized his rake. The monster fled, but Pigsy was in time to get in a tremendous blow. Something fell to the ground with a clang.
I've smashed his helmet,
cried Pigsy. And Monkey, resuming his proper shape, picked up a great fish scale about the size of an ice dish.
Up we go,
he shouted, and both of them sprang into the air. It so happened that the monster was on his way to a dinner party and was therefore unarmed.
Who are you? He shouted up at them. That you should come here interfering with my rights and damaging my reputation.
It is time you should know, said Monkey. We are disciples of Tripitaka, who is going to India to get scriptures. We heard last night of the filthy orgies in which you indulge, and determined to save the lives of the victims and put you under arrest. Come now, confess the truth. How long has this been going on? How many boys and girls have you devoured? If you render me a full account, perhaps I will spare your life.
At this the monster fled, and before Pigsy could get in another blow, he had changed into a gust of wind and disappeared into the river.
We won't waste our time in chasing him,
said Monkey.
Tomorrow we'll arrange a plan for disposing of him finally and getting our master across the river.
They went back to the temple, and collecting the beasts and other things brought for the sacrifice, they returned to the farm. Tripitaka, Sandy, and the two brothers were anxiously waiting for news when Monkey and Pigsy suddenly appeared in the courtyard, driving the sacrificial animals and dumping down the holy gear.
How did the sacrifice go?
Asked Tripitaka. Monkey told them what had happened. The two old men were delighted, and at once ordered the best room to be got ready for the pilgrims. Soon all were soundly asleep. When the monster got back to his palace under the river, he threw himself onto his throne and sat in complete silence. His watery kinsfolk were astonished to see him looking so glum.
You're usually in such high spirits after the sacrifice, they said.
Yes, he said, and I've always been able to bring back some titbits for all of you, but today I didn't even get anything to eat myself. I met my match and came near to losing my life.
And he told them his story.
Tripitaka, he added, is of such sanctity that anyone who ate the least scrap of his flesh would live forever. But now that he has got such disciples as this, I very much doubt if I can catch him.
Then from among his watery kinsmen there stepped out a stripy-coated perch mother, wriggling and bowing.
If you want to catch Tripitaka,
she said,
nothing could be easier. But if I tell you how, what reward will you give me?
If you give me a good plan and enable me to catch him,
said the monster,
I will adopt you as my sister, and you shall eat him, sitting with me on the same mat.
Well, then, she said, I know that you can call the wind and make rain, but can you bring down snow?
Certainly,
he said.
And can you make it so cold that everything freezes?
I can,
he said.
In that case,
she said,
all is easy.
Let's hear about it,
said the monster.
It is already the third night watch,
said the perch mother.
You must get to work at once. First you must raise a cold wind, then send down a great fall of snow and make it so cold that the river freezes right across. Some of us who are good at transformations must take on human form and must go about on the ice where the road runs down to the river, shouldering packs, umbrella in hand. Tripitaka is in a great hurry to get to India, and when he sees people walking on the ice, he will insist on going across. You will be sitting quietly here at the heart of the river, and as soon as you hear his footsteps above you, will cause the ice to crack. He and his disciples will all fall into the hole, and at one stroke, you will have them all in your power.
Splendid!
Cried the monster. And leaving his watery home, he went up into the sky, set the wind in motion, made a snowstorm, and caused the great river to freeze all over. Just before dawn, Tripitaka and his disciples suddenly began to shiver. Pigsy kept on sneezing and coughing, could not sleep.
"Brother, it's very cold,"
he called out at last.
"Fool," said Monkey. "Where's your spirit? Pilgrims don't feel either heat or cold. What does it matter to us how much it freezes?"
"Disciple,"
said Tripitaka,
"there is something in what he says. It is remarkably cold."
None of them could sleep, and soon they all tumbled out of bed, dressed, opened the door, and looked out. Everything was white. It had evidently been snowing hard for some time.
"It's no wonder you were cold,"
said Monkey,
"in such a snowstorm as this."
They all gazed at the lovely snow. Down it fluttered in pale silken threads and flying splinters of jade. When they had admired its beauty for some time, two servants of the house came along and began to brush the paths. Others brought them hot water to wash in and hot tea, and milk cakes soon followed. Braises were brought, and they all sat down in the parlour. By the time they had finished breakfast, it was snowing harder than ever, and soon there was more than 2 feet of snow on the ground. Tripitaka became very uneasy about the prospects of the journey and burst into tears.
"Calm yourself, father," said Mr. Chain. "The sight of so much snow need not distress you. The house is well stocked with provisions, and we can provide for you as long as you choose to stay."
"You do not understand the cause of my anxiety," said Tripitaka. "When I received the Emperor's bidding to go upon this pilgrimage, His Majesty accompanied me to the frontier, and when presenting the cup of parting, he asked me how long I should be away. I had no idea how difficult the journey would prove, and promptly replied, 'It will take me 3 years to fetch the scriptures and bring them back.' But 7 years have passed, and still I have not seen Buddha's face. The thought that I have exceeded the appointed time weighs heavily upon me. Fortunately, my disciples were able last night to render you a small service, and I was thinking of making bold to ask you if you could give us a boat in which to cross the river. But now this great snowstorm threatens to postpone our journey for I know not how many months, and my return is again delayed."
"Surely a few days, one way or the other, can't make all that difference,"
said Mr. Chien.
"Wait till the weather clears, and I will undertake to get you across the river, even if it costs my whole patrimony."
So elaborate was the luncheon that was served that Tripitaka became quite uneasy. "We can only consent to a further stay," he said, "if you are willing to treat us informally as members of the family."
"There is no number of banquets, however many days running,"
said the old man,
"that could ever repay you for saving our children from their doom."
Soon afterwards the snow stopped, and people began to go about again. Seeing that Tripitaka was looking depressed, Mr. Chien had the paths of the flower garden swept. A big brazier was brought, and they were all invited to come and sit in a snow cave by way of distraction.
"What's this old fellow thinking of?"
cried Pigsy.
"A flower garden is a place to go in springtime. In this cold, with everything buried under the snow, what pleasure can it be?"
"Fool," said Monkey. You do not know what you're talking about. Snowbound scenes have a mysterious calm, which is delightful to enjoy, and will soothe our master's feelings.
When they had admired the scene for some while, they sat in the snow cave, and some neighbours who had joined them were told about the pilgrimage. When they had all drunk perfumed tea, Mr. Chien asked,
"Do you reverent gentlemen drink wine?"
"I do not," said Tripitaka, "but my disciples will drink a cup or two of weak wine." It was now getting late, and it was announced that supper was ready in the house. At this moment, someone in the street was heard saying,
"This is something like cold. The river has frozen."
"Monkey, that sounds bad for us," groaned Tripitaka.
"The cold came on very suddenly," said Mr. Chien. "Probably it only means that the shallow water near the bank has been frozen."
But the man who had given the news replied, "It is frozen the whole way across, smooth as the face of a mirror, and people are walking about on the ice where the road goes down to the river." When Tripitaka heard that people were walking on the ice, he wanted to go at once and look.
"Don't be in a hurry," said Mr. Chien. "It's late now. Tomorrow we'll go and look."
Then they parted with the neighbours, and when supper was over, retired to rest. Pigsy, when he woke, announced that it was colder than ever. Tripitaka went to the door, and prostrating himself, uttered the following prayer: "Deities that guard the faith, in our journey to the west we have braved the perils of hill and stream, that we might at last see Buddha face to face. Never have we grumbled or repined. Now we see before us strong evidence of heaven's help, in that this river has frozen so that it can be crossed. We swear that on our return we will inform our emperor of this favour, and he will repay you with manifold offerings." Then he ordered Pigsy to saddle the horse and get ready to cross the river while it was still frozen.
"Don't be in a hurry," said Mr. Chien.
"In a few days the ice will have melted, and I will do my poor best to provide you with a boat."
"I am not for going at once or for staying on," said Sandy. "We have only heard about the river being frozen and have not seen for ourselves. While we are saddling the horse, I suggest that the master should go and have a look."
"There is some sense in that," said Mr. Chien, and he told his servants to saddle 6 horses, but not to let Tripitaka's horse be saddled for the present.
Then they all rode down to the river to look. It was true enough that people were walking across the ice.
"Where are they going?"
asked Tripitaka.
"They are traders," said Mr. Chien, "from the country on the other side of the river. Things that here are worth 100 strings of cash are worth 10,000 on the other side, and things that are there worth only 100 are here worth 2,000. So great are the profits to be made that they are willing to undertake the journey even at the risk of their lives. In ordinary times, 6 or 7 or even 10 will pack into one boat and cross even in the heavy storms. And directly they saw that the river was frozen, what they naturally come pouring across on foot."
"The men of the world," said Tripitaka, "stake all on profit and fame. But it must not be forgotten that we pilgrims too, in carrying out the imperial behest, are also seeking fame, and we must not allow ourselves to feel too superior. Monkey, go back at once to our benefactor's house, put together the luggage, saddle the horse, and let us cross while the ice is thick."
"Master," said Sandy, "the proverb says, in 1,000 days one eats up 1,000 measures of rice. As we are offered the use of Mr. Chien's house, would it not be wiser to wait a few days till the weather changes and the ice melts, and then cross in a boat? It is a mistake to be in too much of a hurry."
"I am surprised that you should take such a view," said Tripitaka. "If it were the end of winter and getting warmer every day, it might be good to wait till the ice melts. But it is the 8th month, when the weather grows colder every day. If we wait,
we shall lose half a year of travelling.
Stop your chattering,
said Pigsy, dismounting from his horse,
and let me go and see how thick the ice really is.
Fool, said Monkey, do you think you can find that out by throwing a stone, as you found out how deep the water was before?
You don't understand,
said Pigsy.
I'll strike the ice with my rake. If the ice breaks, that means it's thin, and we won't trust it. If it doesn't give, that means it's thick, and we can walk on it.
That sounds sensible, said Tripitaka.
The fool hitched up his coat, went to the edge of the river, and lifting the rake in both hands, struck with all his might.
There was a tremendous bang, and 9 white marks appeared on the ice.
Let's be off, he cried. I'll guarantee that it's firm right to the bottom.
Tripitaka was delighted. They all went back to Mr. Chien's and prepared for the journey. Unable to prevail upon them to stay, Mr. Chien insisted upon their accepting some dry provisions and pastries to take with them, and all the household gathered round bowing and kowtowing. A dish of broken pieces of gold and silver was also brought, and Mr. Chien asked them to accept a small contribution to the expenses of their journey as a return for the service they had rendered to the family. Tripitaka shook his head.
I have left the world, he said. Of what use is money to me? It is our duty to live entirely on such alms as are offered to us upon the road. It is enough that we should accept the provisions you have kindly offered.
When the old man had renewed the offer several times, Monkey plunged his hand into the dish and brought out some pieces worth about 5 string of cash in all. Giving them to Tripitaka, he said,
Here's some pocket money for you. Take it, or Mr. Chien will be disappointed.
Then they parted and made for the river bank. When they got onto the ice, the horse began to slip about, and Tripitaka was nearly thrown.
Master, said Sandy, it's bad going.
We had better go back and ask them for some straw, said Pigsy.
Straw?
Said Monkey.
What for?
You wouldn't know, said Pigsy. If we bind straw to the horse's hoofs, it wouldn't slip, and the master wouldn't fall off.
So they got some straw, and when Pigsy had tied it to the horse's hoofs, they set out once more. They had gone 3 or 4 leagues when Pigsy took Tripitaka's staff and made him carry it crosswise.
Now what's this fool up to?
Cried Monkey.
It's his business to carry the staff. Why has he made the master carry it?
You've never been on ice, so you don't know, said Pigsy. Ice always has holes in it. If one puts one's foot in a hole, down one goes. And unless one is holding a stick crosswise, like this, one can't stop oneself. The ice closes above like the lid of a kettle, and one never gets out again. The thing to do is to hold a stick crosswise, like this.
One would think he had spent all his time going on the ice,
said Monkey, laughing. They all did, as he said. Tripitaka held the staff across his knees. Monkey held his cudgel, Sandy his priest's staff, and Pigsy, who had the luggage on his back, tied the rake sideways at his waist. They went on, all feeling perfectly secure. When darkness fell, they ate some of their provisions, but did not dare halt, and with the moonlight glittering in dazzling whiteness over the ice, they rode on, never closing their eyes, all night. When it grew light, they ate some more of their provisions, and then went on towards the west. After some time, a rending sound suddenly came from under the ice. The white horse plunged and almost lost its footing.
Disciple, what is that noise?
Asked Tripitaka.
It's freezing so hard, said Pigsy, that the earth at the bottom of the river is hardening. Soon we shall have one solid block under our feet.
Tripitaka was astonished and delighted. He whipped on his horse, and away they went.
Meanwhile, the great king and his kinsfolk were waiting below. Hearing at last the sound of hoofs, he so deployed his magic power as to open a long cleft in the ice.
Monkey immediately leapt into the air, but the white horse went straight in, and so did the other disciples. The monster grabbed a Tripitaka, and he and his kinsfolk swiftly carried him down to the water palace.
"Where's my perch, sister?"
shouted the great king.
"At your service,"
she said, approaching the gate and curtsying.
"But as for sister, no, really, I can't allow it."
"Be careful," he said, "or I shall take you at your word. A team of horses cannot overtake a word that has left the mouth. I promised to call you sister if your plan put Tripitaka into my hands, and sister you must be."
Then he called to his servants to set the tables, grind the knives, rip out Tripitaka's heart, and then flay and carve him, and to see to it that there was music.
"For I and my sister are going to eat him," he said, "that we may live forever."
"Great king," she said, "if we eat him now, his disciples may come in the middle and spoil the fun. We had better lie low for a couple of days, and if these wretches don't come to look for him, we'll split open his breast and hold our feast. Your Majesty will preside, and all our tribe shall be there to entertain you with flute, string, song, and dance. In that way, we shall be able to enjoy the treat quite at our ease. Isn't that a better plan?"
The king agreed, and Tripitaka was taken and laid in a long stone chest that stood at the back of the palace. The lid was put on, and there we leave him. Meanwhile, Pigsy and Sandy fished the luggage out of the water and packed it on the horse's back. Then they all began swimming towards the shore.
"What has become of Tripitaka?"
asked Monkey, looking down from aloft.
"There's no such person," said Pigsy. "Down among the dead men is his ticket now. There's no use worrying any more about him. We'll make him for sure. When we get there, we'll decide what's to be done next."
Now, Pigsy had once been a marshal of the hosts of heaven, and had commanded 80,000 water warriors of the River of Heaven. Sandy came from the Flowing Sands, and the white horse was a grandchild of the Dragon King of the Western Ocean. So all three of them were quite at home in the water. Led by Monkey from above, they made the journey much quicker than they had come, and scrambling up the bank, they scrubbed down the horse, wrung out their clothes, and, joined by Monkey, all went back to Mr. Chien's house.
"They have come back again,"
someone announced to Mr. Chien,
"but there are only three of them."
As soon as they arrived at the door, Mr. Chien saw that their clothes were wet.
"I told you so,"
he said.
"I begged you to stay, but you would not listen to me. If you had, you would not now be in this sad state. And what has become of Tripitaka?"
"That's not his name now," said Pigsy. "He's known as Old Down at the Bottom."
Both the old men burst into tears.
"If only he had waited till the ice melted and taken a boat,"
they wailed.
"His obstinacy has cost him his life."
"Don't distress yourselves unduly,"
said Monkey.
"I've a notion that the master will live a long time yet. This is just a trick of that monster's. Meanwhile, don't worry, but get our clothes put through the mangle, dry our passports, have the white horse well fed, and then we'll go and find this creature, rescue the master, and get this business settled once and for all. Then I hope you'll all have a quiet time for a long while to come."
The old men were satisfied by this, and ordered a good supper to be brought in. When the pilgrims had eaten their fill, they asked the people of the place to look after the horse, and, weapon in hand, went off to the river to look for the monster. And if you do not know how they saved Tripitaka, you must listen to what is told in the next chapter.
"Now we have got to decide which of us is to go down under the water first,"
said Monkey, when he reached the bank.
"Brother," said Pigsy, "neither Sandy nor I can match half your tricks. It's clear that you should go first."
"The trouble is,"
said Monkey,
"that I am not at my best in the water. I have to be making magic passes all the time to protect myself from it. You are both of you water experts and had better go in together.
I can manage the water all right,
said Sandy.
But I don't know what it's going to be like when we get to the bottom. Let's all go together. Shall you transform yourself into something?
Went on Sandy.
Or shall we carry you? In any case, when we get to the creature's lair, you must go on ahead and see how things stand. If the master really is there and alive, we're all charged to the assault, but it may turn out that it wasn't the great king who carried him off at all. He may just have been drowned. On the other hand, the king may already have eaten him. In that case, there's no more we can do, and we had better make off in some other direction as fast as we can.
Good, said Monkey.
Which of you will carry me?
Pigsy saw his opportunity.
This monkey, he said to himself, has had I don't know how many games at my expense, but he is not at home in the water, and if I offer to carry him, I have a chance of getting my own back. I'll carry you, brother, he said.
Monkey saw at once that there was something in the wind and made his plans accordingly.
All right,
he said.
You are stronger in the back than Sandy.
So Pigsy took him on his back, and Sandy led the way. When they had almost reached the bottom, he began his game. Monkey felt that it was coming, and plucking a hair, he changed it into the semblance of himself, which remained on Piggy's back, while the real monkey changed into a hog-louse and clung tight to Pigsy's ear. Pigsy, as he went, suddenly made a great jolt, intending to send Monkey flying over his head, but the sham monkey, being nothing but a transformed hare, merely fluttered away and disappeared.
"Brother," said Sandy, "do you know what you have done? It's not very good going, and anyone might slip about a bit, but you've jolted our brother right off your back, and how is anyone to know where he's fallen to?"
"That monkey," said Pigsy, "ought surely to be able to stand a little jolting. What's the good of a fellow who just vanishes at the first jolt? Don't let us worry about what has become of him. You and I will go and look for the master."
"I am not going without him,"
said Sandy.
"You and I may be good at going in the water, but we are not up to half his tricks."
Monkey, firmly lodged in Pigsy's ear, could not refrain from crying out,
"I'm here."
"That's done it,"
said Sandy.
"Ghosts are heard, but not seen. He is certainly dead. What possessed you to try that game with him?"
Pigsy, in great perturbation, knelt down and said, kowtowing, "Brother, I ought not to have done it. When we have rescued Tripitaka and are on land again, I will apologize properly. Where are you talking from? You frighten me to death. Show yourself in your true form, and I will carry you properly and give you no more jolts."
"You are carrying me now,"
said Monkey.
"Gee up, and I won't tease you."
Mumbling to himself about his apology, Pigsy scrambled to his feet and went on. Suddenly they saw a notice with Turtle House written on it.
"That must be where the monster is living,"
said Sandy.
"Let's go and taunt him to battle."
"Do you suppose there is water at the gate?"
said Monkey.
"There clearly isn't,"
said Sandy.
"Well then,"
said Monkey,
"you two go and hide at each side of the door, and I'll prospect."
So saying, he crawled out of Pigsy's ear, shook himself, changed into a long-legged crab mother, and sidled in at the door. There was the monster, with his kinfolk round him, and the perch mother at his side. They were discussing how they should eat Tripitaka. But looking about on all sides, Monkey could not anywhere see the master. Presently he saw a crab mother sidling along the corridor.
"A granny,"
he said, going up to her.
"They are deciding about the eating of this Chinese priest. What have they done with him in the meanwhile?"
"They put him in the stone chest behind the palace,"
said she.
"They're not going to eat him till tomorrow for fear his disciples come along and kick up a fuss. If everything is all right then, There'll be music and great goings-on.
Monkey chatted with her for a little while, and then went behind the palace where, sure enough, he found a stone chest, rather like some pigsties that people make of stone or a sepulchral sarcophagus. He bent over the chest and soon heard Tripitaka blubbering piteously.
Master,
he called,
do not grieve. The flood scripture says, earth is the mother of the five elements, water is the source of the five elements. Without earth we could not be born, but without water we could not grow. Take comfort in this and in the fact that I have come.
Save me, disciple,
groaned Tripitaka.
Don't worry,
said Monkey.
Wait till we have caught the monster, and we'll soon get you out.
I hope you'll be quick about it, said Tripitaka. If I stay here another day, I shall succumb.
That's all right,
said Monkey.
Off I go.
Well, brother, how do things stand?
Asked Sandy when Monkey reappeared in his true form.
The master has indeed been captured,
Monkey said,
but so far no harm has been done to him. The monster has put him into a stone chest. You two had better go and give battle, and I'll return to the surface. If you can catch the monster, do so. If you can't, pretend to give in and retreat to the surface, enticing him to follow you. Then you can leave him to me.
Look at Pigsy, he goes, blustering to the door.
Monster, he cries, give us back our master.
Some little imps at the door rushed in and announced,
Great King, there is someone outside asking for his master.
I know what that means,
said the monster.
That cursed priest has come. Quick, bring me my whole outfit,
he cried. Armed to the teeth, he called his imps to open the door and came striding out, followed by 110 satellites, all swinging halberds or brandishing swords.
What temple do you come from, and why are you making the scene at my door?
He thundered.
Insensate creature, cried Pigsy. I had a chat with you only a few nights ago. How can you pretend that you do not know me? I am a disciple of Tripitaka, who is going to India to fetch scriptures. You have the effrontery to call yourself Great King and think yourself entitled to eat girls and boys from the village. I am your victim, the girl Load of Gold. Don't you recognize me?
Are you aware that you could be sued for impersonation?
Said the monster.
As things turned out, I didn't eat you, and in fact did you no harm, but you gave me a nasty knock. I should have thought you would have been glad enough to escape alive, instead of coming pestering me at home.
No harm, indeed, cried Pigsy. Isn't it enough that you trapped my master under the ice? Give him back to us at once, and we'll say no more about it. But if so much as half the word no leaves your lips, just have a look at this rake and know what to expect.
Well, if you must needs know,
said the monster, smiling sourly.
I confess it was I who made the frost and seized upon your master, but I must warn you that if you want to pick a quarrel with me, things won't go quite like last time. Then I was going to a dinner party and had no weapons with me. This time I have got my battle mallet. I challenge you to 3 bouts. If you can get the better of me, you shall have back your master. But if you can't, I shall eat you as well as him.
Pretty fellow, said Pigsy. All I ask for is a fight. Have a good look at this rake.
I can see that you were not a priest to start with,
said the monster.
What makes you think that?
Said Pigsy.
I can tell by your rake,
said the monster.
You must have worked in a vegetable garden and run off with the owner's muck rake.
My boy, said Pigsy, you are much mistaken if you think that this is an ordinary garden rake. It could comb the ocean and scare the dragons out of their beds.
The monster paid no heed to these boastings, but raised his brazen mallet and struck at Pigsy's head. Pigsy warded off the blow with his rake, saying,
"Cursed creature, I can see that you were not an ogre to start with."
Can you indeed?
Said the monster.
How do you make that out?
I can tell by the way you use your mallet, said Pigsy. You must have worked in a silversmith's forge and run off with your master's mallet.
You're much mistaken, said the monster. If you imagine that this is an ordinary silver worker's mallet, it comes from the Garden of the Immortals, where it was tempered in magic fountains so that no axe, spear, halberd, or sword can withstand it.
Sandy, seeing them engaged in dispute, could not refrain from stepping up and shouting,
Monster, waste no more random talk. The men of old said, what the mouth speaks proves nothing. Only by deeds can men be judged. Stand your ground and eat my staff.
I can see that you weren't a priest to start with,
said the monster, fending off the blow.
How do you know?
Said Sandy.
You look to me as though you had worked in a pastry cook's shop at one time or another,
said he.
What makes you think that?
Said Sandy.
Well, if not,
said the monster,
where did you learn to use that rolling pin of yours?
Monster, cried Sandy, learn to use your eyes. This is no common article, but a weapon so unique in the world that few have ever heard of it. This staff came from the most secret recesses of the Palace of the Moon, and is guaranteed to shatter all the majesty of heaven at a single blow.
For 2 hours, the three of them battled at the bottom of the water without victory on either side. At last, seeing that the monster could not be overcome, Pigsy winked at Sandy, and both of them pretended to give up the fight and made away at top speed.
Little ones, said the monster, stay on guard here while I chase these fellows. When I have caught them, you shall all have your share to eat.
Look at him. Like a leaf driven by the autumn wind or a fallen petal struck down by the rain, he fled after them up to the outer air.
Monkey was watching the water intently. Suddenly he saw a great heaving of the waves and heard a noise of grunting and panting.
Here we are,
cried Pigsy, jumping out onto the bank. He was soon followed by Sandy, and a moment later the monster's head appeared above the water.
Look out for my cudgel,
cried Monkey. The monster ducked and fended the blow with his mallet. They had not finished 3 bouts when the monster, unable any longer to fend Monkey's blows and worn out, slipped down into the stream, and all was quiet again.
Brother, said Sandy, you were a match for him up here, but now he's down below again, things are as bad as ever. How are we to rescue the master?
It's no good going on like this, said Monkey. You two stay here and see that he doesn't slip off somewhere, and I'll go away.
Away? Where to? Cried Pigsy.
I'm going to the Bodhisattva in the Southern Ocean, said Monkey, to find out who this monster really is. When I know, I shall go to his ancestral home, seize all his friends and relations, and then come back here, deal with the creature himself, and rescue the master.
Brother, said Pigsy, that all sounds very roundabout, and will waste a lot of time.
Not a bit of it, said Monkey. I shan't waste a minute. I'll be back almost before I start. Dear Monkey, he shot up on a shaft of magic light and was soon at the Southern Ocean. In less than half an hour, Mount Potalaka rose up before him. He lowered his cloud and was met by the 24 Devas, the guardian spirits of the mountain, Moksha, and the Dragon King's daughter carrying the pearl.
Great sage, what brings you here? They asked.
I have business with the Bodhisattva, he said.
She left her cave early this morning, said they, allowing no one to follow her, and went into the bamboo grove. But she evidently expected you, for she told us to receive you here if you came, and not to bring you to her at once. Just sit down here for a while, and wait till she comes out of the grove.
Monkey soon grew tired of waiting. You might tell her, said he, that if she doesn't come soon, it may be too late to save Tripitaka's life. We dare not do that, said the divinities. The Bodhisattva said you were to wait till she came.
Monkey was by nature extremely impatient, and presently he strode off towards the cave.
"Hello, Bodhisattva,"
he cried when he reached it.
"Your servant Monkey pays his humble compliments."
"Kindly wait outside," said Kuan Yin.
"Bodhisattva,"
he cried, kowtowing,
"my master is in difficulties, and I have come to you to get particulars about the monster that haunts the river that flows to heaven."
"Go away and wait till I come out," she repeated.
Monkey dared not disobey, and going back to the divinities, he said,
"I got a glimpse of the Bodhisattva. I don't know what she's up to today. Instead of sitting on her lotus terrace, she's poked away all by herself in the bamboo grove, paring bamboo strips. She's not even bothered to make up or put on her jewels." "We know no more than you do,"
they said. "But as she is expecting you, she's probably doing something on your behalf." There was nothing for it but to wait again. After a while, the Bodhisattva came out of the grove carrying a bamboo basket.
"Come along,"
she said.
"We'll go and rescue Tripitaka."
"I shouldn't like to hurry you,"
said Monkey, kneeling.
"Wouldn't you like to finish dressing first?"
"I can't be bothered," she said. "I'm going just as I am."
She sailed away on her cloud roll, followed by Monkey.
"That's quick work,"
said Pigsy, when they appeared above the river bank.
"It takes a lot of hustling to make a Bodhisattva come straight along without even doing her hair or putting on her jewels."
The Bodhisattva floated low over the river, and then tying her sash, tied the basket to it and trailed it through the water upstream.
"The dead go, the living stay."
When she had repeated this charm 7 times, she drew up the basket. In it flashed the tail of a golden fish. Its eyes blinked and its tail twitched.
"Go at once into the water and fetch up your master," cried the Bodhisattva.
"But I haven't dealt yet with the monster,"
protested Monkey.
"The monster is in this basket," said the Bodhisattva.
"What?"
cried Pigsy and Sandy.
"A fish do all that harm?"
"It is a goldfish that I reared in my lotus pond. Every day it used to put its head out and listen to the scriptures, thus acquiring great magical powers. Its mallet was a lotus stalk, topped by an unopened bud that this creature, by its magic, turned into a weapon. One day there was a flood, and it got washed out of the pool and floated out to sea, finally reaching the place where you found him. Leaning on the balustrade and looking at the flowers, I was surprised not to see this fellow coming out to salute me. A close inspection of the ripples convinced me that he had gone this way and might be molesting your master. So, without even stopping to comb my hair or put on my jewels, I plaited this magic basket to capture him in."
"In that case,"
said Monkey,
"wait a minute, and I'll call all the faithful of the village to come and gaze upon your golden visage. They will be glad to show their gratitude, and we can tell them just how the monster was recovered. That will increase the faith of these mortals and promote their piety."
"Very well, then," said the Bodhisattva. "Go and fetch them quickly."
Pigsy and Sandy ran back to the farm and shouted,
"All of you come and see the living Bodhisattva."
Men and women, young and old, all trooped to the river bank, and regardless of puddles and mud, flung themselves to their knees. Among them there happened to be a skilful painter who made a portrait of the Bodhisattva, and this was the beginning of the form of Kuan Yin known as Kuan Yin with the fish basket. Soon she withdrew to the southern ocean, and Pigsy and Sandy made their way down through the water to Turtle House. Here they found all the monster's fish followers lying dead and rotting. Going behind the palace, they soon hoisted Tripitaka out of the stone chest and carried him back through the waves.
"We are afraid, reverend sir, that you've let yourself in for a very bad time by declining our invitation to stay on,"
said the brothers Chien when Tripitaka arrived.
"There's no need to harp on that now,"
said Monkey.
The main thing is that next year the village will not have to supply victims for the sacrifice. You are rid of your great king forever and need fear no more. We must now trouble you to find us a boat to take us across the river.
You shall have it,
cried Mr. Chien, and he ordered planks to be sawn and a boat made. The people of the village vied with one another in helping with the equipment. One promised to make himself responsible for the masts and sails, another for paddles and poles. One offered to supply ropes, another to pay the sailors. In the midst of all the commotion that was going on by the riverside, a voice was suddenly heard saying, Great sage, you need not trouble to build a boat. It is a waste of good material. I will take you across. So startled were they all, that the more timid bolted back to the village, and even the bolder among them only dared peep cautiously in the direction from which the voice came. In a moment a square white head appeared above the waves, and there presently emerged a huge white turtle.
Great sage, the turtle said again, don't trouble to build a boat. I will take you across.
Cursed creature,
cried Monkey.
Move an inch further and I'll club you to death with this cudgel.
I am deeply beholden to you, said the turtle, and want to show my gratitude by taking you all across. Why do you threaten me with your cudgel?
For what are you beholden to me?
Asked Monkey.
Great sage,
said the turtle,
you do not realize that this turtle house under the river was my home and belonged to my ancestors for generations past. Owing to the magic powers that I won by my austerities, I was able to improve the place considerably and make it into the handsome water palace that you saw. But one day, this monster came churning through the waves and made a wanton attack upon me. In the fight that ensued, many of my children were hurt and many of my kinsmen taken. I could not stand up against him, and my home, with all that was in it, fell into his hands. But now, owing to your having persuaded the Bodhisattva to call in this monster, I have been able to recover possession of my house. I am happily installed there with the remaining kinsmen who I have been able to gather about me. We are not left out in the mud, but can live comfortably in our old home. My gratitude for this is as high as the hills and as deep as the sea. But we are not the only ones to benefit. The people of the village will no longer have to supply children for the yearly sacrifice. It is indeed a case of two gains at one move. Surely it is natural that I should wish to show my gratitude.
Are we really to believe that you are speaking the truth?
Said Monkey, withdrawing his cudgel.
But, great sage, said the turtle, how would I dare to deceive you after all you have done for me?
Swear to heaven that this is the truth,
said Monkey. The turtle opened its red mouth wide and swore as follows.
If I do not bring Tripitaka safely across the river as I have promised to do, may my bones turn into water.
That's good enough, said Monkey. You can come out.
The turtle then pushed close in to shore and lumbered up onto the bank. Pressing round him, the people saw that he had a great white carapace full 40 feet in diameter.
Get on board, said Monkey, and we'll all go across.
Disciple, said Tripitaka, the ice was slippery, but at any rate it stayed still. I'm afraid that this turtle's back will be very unsteady.
Don't worry,
said Monkey. When creatures can speak human language, they generally tell the truth. Come, brothers, make haste and bring our horse.
The white horse was led on to the middle of the turtle's back. Tripitaka stood on the left and Sandy on the right, while Pigsy stood behind its tail. Monkey placed himself in front of the horse's head and, fearing trouble, undid the sash of his tiger-skin apron and tied it to the turtle's nose, holding the other end in one hand, while in the other hand he grasped his iron cudgel. Then, with one foot on the creature's head and the other firmly on its carapace,
"Now, turtle, go gently,"
he cried,
"and remember, at the least sign of a wobble, you'll get a crack on the head."
I shouldn't dare,
said the turtle.
I shouldn't dare.
Then, while the turtle set off smoothly over the waters, the villagers on the bank burned incense and kowtowed, murmuring, Glory be to Buddha, glory be to Buddha. In less than a day, they had safely traversed the whole 800 leagues and arrived with dry hand and dry foot at the further shore. Tripitaka disembarked, and with palms pressed together, thanked the turtle, saying, "It affects me deeply that I have nothing to give you in return for all your trouble. I hope that when I come back with the scriptures, I shall be able to show you my gratitude."
"Master,"
said the turtle, "I should not dream of accepting a reward, but there is one thing you can do for me. I have heard that the Buddha of the Western Heaven knows both the past and the future. I have been perfecting myself here for about 1,000 years. That is a pretty long span, and I have already been fortunate enough to learn human speech, but I still remain a turtle. I should indeed be very much obliged if you would ask the Buddha how long it will be before I achieve human form."
"I promise to ask,"
said Tripitaka. The turtle then disappeared into the depths of the river. Monkey helped Tripitaka onto his horse, Pigsy shouldered the luggage, and Sandy brought up the rear. They soon found their way back to the main road and set out for the west. If you do not know how far they still had to travel, and whether disasters still awaited them, you must listen to what is told in the next chapter. They travelled westward for many months, and at last began to be aware that the country through which they were now passing was different from any that they had seen. Everywhere they came across gem-like flowers and magical grasses, with many ancient cypresses and hoary pines. In the villages through which they passed, every family seemed to devote itself to the entertainment of priests and other pious works. On every hill were hermits practicing austerities, in every wood, pilgrims chanting holy writ. Finding hospitality each night, and starting again at dawn, they journeyed for many days, till they came at last within sudden sight of a cluster of high eaves and towers.
"Monkey, that's a fine place,"
said Tripitaka, pointing to it with his whip.
"Considering," said Monkey, "how often you have insisted upon prostrating yourself at the sight of false magicians' palaces and arch-impostors' lairs, it is strange that when at last you see before you Buddha's true citadel, you should not even dismount from your horse."
At this, Tripitaka, in great excitement, sprang from his saddle, and, walking beside the horse, was soon at the gates of the high building. A young Taoist came out to meet them.
"Aren't you the people who have come from the east to fetch scriptures?"
he asked. Tripitaka hastily tied at his clothes, and looking up, saw that the boy was clad in gorgeous brocades and carried a bowl of jade dust in his hand. Monkey knew him at once.
"This,"
he said to Tripitaka,
"is the golden-crested great immortal of the Jade Truth Temple at the foot of the Holy Mountain."
Tripitaka at once advanced, bowing.
"Well, here you are at last,"
said the immortal.
"The Bodhisattva misinformed me. 10 years ago she was told by Buddha to go to China and find someone who would fetch scriptures from India. She told me she had found someone who would arrive here in 2 or 3 years. Year after year I waited, but never a sign. This meeting is indeed a surprise." "I cannot thank you enough, great immortal, for your patience,"
said Tripitaka. Then they all went into the temple and were shown round by the immortal. Tea and refreshments were served, and perfumed hot water was brought for Tripitaka to wash in. Soon they all turned in for the night.
Early next day, Tripitaka changed into his brocaded cassock and jewelled cap, and, staff in hand, presented himself to the immortal in the hall of the temple to take his leave. "That's better,"
said the immortal.
"Yesterday you were looking a bit shabby, but now you look like a true child of Buddha."
Tripitaka was just going when the immortal stopped him, saying,
"You must let me see you off." "It's really not necessary,"
said Tripitaka.
"Monkey knows the way."
"He only knows the way by air,"
said the immortal.
"You have got to go on the ground."
"That's true enough,"
said Monkey.
We will trouble you just to set us on the right way. My master is pining to get into the presence of the Buddha, and it would be a pity if there were any delay.
Taking Tripitaka by the hand, he led him right through the temple and out at the back, for the road did not go from the front gate, but traversed the courtyards and led on to the hill behind.
"You see that highest point wreathed in magic rainbow mists?"
said the immortal, pointing to the mountain.
"That is the Vulture Peak, the sacred precinct of the Buddha."
Tripitaka at once began kowtowing.
"Master,"
said Monkey,
"you had better keep that for later on. If you are going to kowtow all the way to the top, there won't be much left of your head by the time we get there. It's still a long way off."
"You stand already on blessed ground," said the immortal.
"The holy mountain is before you. I shall now turn back."
Monkey led them up the hill at a leisurely pace. They had not gone more than 5 or 6 leagues when they came to a great water about 8 leagues wide. It was exceedingly swift and rough. No one was to be seen in any direction.
"I don't think this can be the right way,"
said Tripitaka.
"Do you think that the immortal can possibly have been mistaken? This water is so wide and so rough that we cannot possibly get across."
"This is the way, all right,"
said Monkey.
"Look, just over there is a bridge. That's the right way to salvation."
Presently, Tripitaka came to a notice board on which was written Cloud Reach Bridge. But it proved, when they came up to it, that the bridge consisted simply of slim tree trunks laid end on end and was hardly wider than the palm of a man's hand.
"Monkey,"
protested Tripitaka in great alarm,
"it's not humanly possible to balance on such a bridge as that. We must find some other way to get across."
"This is the right way,"
said Monkey, grinning.
"It may be the right way,"
said Pigsy,
"but it's so narrow and slippery that no one would ever dare set foot on it. And think how far there is to go and what it's like underneath."
"All wait where you are and watch while I show you how,"
cried Monkey. Dear Monkey, he strode up to the bridge, leapt lightly onto it, and had soon slipped across.
"I'm over,"
he shouted, waving from the other side. Tripitaka showed no sign of following him, and Pigsy and Sandy bit their fingers, murmuring,
"Can't be done, can't be done."
Monkey sprang back again, and pulling at Pigsy, saying,
"Fool, follow me across."
But Pigsy lay on the ground and would not budge.
"It's much too slippery,"
he said.
"Let me off. Why can't I have a wind to carry me?"
"What would be the good of that?"
said Monkey.
"Unless you go by the bridge, you won't turn into a Buddha."
"Buddha or no Buddha,"
said Pigsy,
"I'm not going on that bridge."
The quarrel was at its height when Sandy ran between them and at last succeeded in making peace.
Suddenly, Tripitaka saw someone punting a boat towards the shore and crying, "Ferry, ferry!"
"Stop your quarrelling, disciples,"
said Tripitaka.
"A boat is coming."
They all gazed with one accord at the spot to which he pointed. A boat was coming, indeed. But when it was a little nearer, they saw to their consternation that it had no bottom. Monkey, with his sharp eyes, had already recognized the ferryman as the Conductor of Souls, also called Light of the Banner. But he did not tell the others, merely crying,
"Ahoy, ferry, ahoy!"
When the boat was along shore, the ferryman again cried,
"Ferry, ferry!"
"Your boat is broken and bottomless,"
said Tripitaka, much perturbed.
"How can you take people across?"
"You may well think," said the ferryman, "that in a bottomless boat such a river as this could never be crossed, but since the beginning of time I have carried countless souls to their salvation."
"Get on board, master,"
said Monkey.
"You will find that this boat, although it has no bottom, is remarkably steady, however rough the waters may be."
Seeing Tripitaka still hesitate, Monkey took him by the scruff of the neck and pushed him on board. There was nothing for Tripitaka's feet to rest on, and he went straight into the water. The ferryman caught at him and dragged him up to the side of the boat. Sitting miserably there, he wrung out his clothes, shook out his shoes, and grumbled at Monkey for having got him into this scrape. But Monkey, taking no notice, put Pigsy and Sandy, horse and baggage, all on board, ensconcing them as best he could in the gunwale. The ferryman punted them dexterously out from shore. Suddenly they saw a body in the water, drifting rapidly downstream. Tripitaka stared at it in consternation. Monkey laughed.
"Don't be frightened, master," he said. "That's you."
And Pigsy said,
"It's you! It's you!"
Sandy clapped his hands.
"It's you! It's you!"
he cried. The ferryman, too, joined in the chorus.
"There you go!"
he cried.
"My best congratulations!"
He went on punting, and in a very short while they were all safe and sound at the other side. Tripitaka stepped lightly ashore. He had discarded his earthly body. He was cleansed from the corruption of the senses, from the fleshly inheritance of those bygone years. He was now the transcendent wisdom that leads to the further shore, the mastery that knows no bounds. When they were at the top of the bank, they turned round and found to their astonishment that boat and ferryman had both vanished. Only then did Monkey tell them who the ferryman was. Tripitaka began thanking his disciples for all they had done for him.
"Every one of us," said Monkey, "is equally indebted to the other. If the master had not received our vows and accepted us as his disciples, we should not have had the chance to do good works and win salvation. If we had not protected the master and mounted guard over him, he would never have got rid of his mortal body. Look, master, at this realm of flowers and happy creatures, of phoenixes, cranes, and deer. Is it not a better place indeed than the haunted deserts through which you and I have passed?"
Tripitaka still murmured his thanks, and with a strange feeling of lightness and exhilaration, they all set off up the holy mountain and were soon in sight of the Temple of the Thunderclap, with its mighty towers brushing the firmament, its giant foundations rooted in the seams of the Hill of Life. Near the top of the hill they came upon a party of Upasakas filing through the green pine woods, and under a clump of emerald cedars they saw bands of the blessed. Tripitaka hastened to bow down to them. Worshippers, male and female, monks and nuns, pressed together the palms of their hands, crying, "Holy priest, it is not to us that your homage should be addressed. Wait till you have seen Sakyamuni, and afterwards come and greet us, each according to his rank."
"He's always in too much of a hurry,"
laughed Monkey.
"Come along at once, and let us pay our respects to the people at the top." Twitching with excitement, Tripitaka followed Monkey to the gates of the temple.
Here they were met by the Vajrapani of the Four Elements.
"So your reverence has at last arrived," he exclaimed.
"Your disciple, Hiswan Tsang, has indeed arrived,"
said Tripitaka, bowing.
"I must trouble you to wait here a moment till your arrival has been announced,"
said the Vajrapani. He then gave instructions to the porter at the outer gate to tell the porter at the second gate that the Vajrapani wished to report that the priest from China had arrived. The porter at the second gate sent word to the porter at the third gate. At this gate were holy priests with direct access to
the powers above. They hurried to the great hall and informed the Tathagata, the most honored one, even Sakyamuni, Buddha himself, that the priest from the court of China had arrived at the mountain to fetch scriptures. Father Buddha was delighted. He ordered the Bodhisattva, Vajrapanis, Arhats, protectors, planets, and temple guardians to form up in two lines. Then he gave orders that the priest of Tiang was to be shown in. Again the word was passed along from gate to gate. The priest of Tiang is to be shown in.
Tripitaka, Monkey, Pigsy, and Sandy, carefully following the rules of etiquette prescribed to them, all went forward, horse and baggage following. When they reached the great hall, they first prostrated themselves before the Tathagata, and then bowed to right and left. This they repeated 3 times, and then knelt before the Buddha and presented their passports. He looked through them one by one, and handed them back to Tripitaka, who bent his head in acknowledgment, saying, "The disciple Iswan Tsang has come by order of the emperor of the great land of Tang all the way to this holy mountain to fetch the true scriptures which are to be the salvation of all mankind. May the Lord Buddha accord this favor and grant me a quick return to my native land." Hereupon the Tathagata opened the mouth of compassion and gave vent to the mercy of his heart. "In all the vast and populous bounds of your eastern land, greed, slaughter, lust, and lying have long prevailed. There is no respect for Buddha's teaching, no striving towards good works. So full and abundant is the measure of the people's sins that they go down forever into the darkness of hell, where some are pounded in mortars, some take on animal form, furry and horned, in which guise they are done by, as they did on earth, their flesh becoming men's food. Confucius stood by their side, teaching them all the virtues. King after king, in vain, corrected them with fresh penalties and pains. No law could curb their reckless debauches. No ray of wisdom could penetrate their blindness. But I have 3 baskets of scripture that can save mankind from its torments and afflictions. One contains the law, which tells of heaven. One contains the discourses which speak of earth. One contains the scriptures which save the dead. They are divided into 35 sections and are written upon 15,144 scrolls. They are the path to perfection, the gate that leads to true good. In them may be learnt all the motions of the stars and divisions of earth, all that appertains to man, bird, beast, flower, tree, and implement of use. In short, all that concerns mankind is found therein. In consideration of the fact that you have come far, I would give you them all to take back. But the people of China are foolish and boisterous. They would mock at my mysteries and would not understand the hidden meaning of our order. Ananda Kaisyapa," he cried, "take these 4 to the room under the tower, and when they have refreshed themselves, open the doors of the treasury, and select from each of the 35 sections a few scrolls for these priests to take back to the east to be a boon there forever." In the lower room they saw countless rarities and treasures, and they were still gazing upon them in wonder when spirits ministrant began to spread the feast. The foods were all fairy fruits and dainties unknown in the common world. Master and disciples bowed acknowledgement of Buddha's favor and set to with a good will. This time it was Pigsy who was in luck and Sandy who scored, for Buddha had provided for their fare such viands as confer long life and health and magically transform the substance of common flesh and bone. When Ananda and Kaisyapa had seen to it that the 4 had all they wanted, they went into the treasury. The moment the door was opened, beams of magic light shone forth, filling the whole air far around. On chests and jeweled boxes were stuck red labels, on which were written the names of the holy books. The 2 disciples of Buddha led Tripitaka up to the place where the scriptures lay, and inviting him to study the title, said, "Having come here from China, you have no doubt brought a few little gifts for us. If you will kindly hand them over, you shall have your scriptures at once." "During my long journey," said Tripitaka, "I have never once found it necessary to lay in anything of the kind.
Splendid, said the disciples.
So we're to spend our days handing over scriptures gratis? Not a very bright outlook for our heirs.
Thinking, by their sarcastic tone, that they had no intention of parting with the scriptures, Monkey could not refrain from shouting angrily,
"Come along, Master. We'll tell Buddha about this and make him come and give us the scriptures himself."
"Don't shout,"
said Ananda.
"There's nothing in the situation that demands all this bullying and blustering. Come here and fetch the scriptures."
Pigsy and Sandy, mastering their rage and managing to restrain Monkey, came across to take the books. Scroll by scroll was packed away into the bundle, which was hoisted onto the horse's back. Then the two luggage packs were tied up and given to Pigsy and Sandy to carry. They first went and kowtowed their thanks to Buddha, and then made for the gates. To every lesser Buddha that they met, they bowed twice, to every Bodhisattva once. Then, leaving the great outer gates, they paid their respects to the groups of monks and nuns, and, saying farewell, went back down the mountain as fast as they could. Now, in an upper room that looked onto the treasury, there happened to be sitting Dipankara, the Buddha of the past. He overheard the whole conversation about the handing over of the scriptures, and had a notion that if they were given no gratuity, Ananda and Kesiapa would revenge themselves by substituting scriptures with nothing in them.
"The poor fools," he said to himself, "certainly have no idea of the trick that is being played on them, and will discover too late that their whole journey has been wasted. Is there anyone here that could take a message for me?"
he asked. The white heroic Bodhisattva stepped forward.
"I want you to put forth all your magic powers," said Dipankara. "Catch up Tripitaka, get those scriptures away from him, and bring him back to get proper ones."
The white heroic Bodhisattva sat astride a whirlwind and made off as fast as his magic powers would carry him. The wind he rode on had a strange perfume, which Tripitaka, when he first perceived it, thought merely to be one of the portents of paradise. But a moment later, a great rushing sound was heard, and a hand, suddenly stretched out from space, seized the scriptures and bore them away.
Tripitaka
beat his breast and groaned. Pigsy rolled off in pursuit, while Sandy clutched at the empty pannier.
Monkey leapt into the air, but the white heroic Bodhisattva, seeing him draw near, feared that he might strike out blindly with his cudgel before any explanation could be given, so he tore open the scripture parcel and threw it to the ground.
Monkey, when he saw the parcel fall and its contents scattered by the scented gale, lowered his cloud and went to see in what condition the scrolls were. He was soon joined by Pigsy, who had given up the pursuit, and they both began collecting the scrolls and bringing them to where Tripitaka was waiting. He was weeping bitterly.
"Little did I think," he sobbed, "that even in paradise we should be thus molested by savage demons."
Sandy now opened one of the scrolls that he had brought. It was snowy white. There was not a trace of so much as half a letter upon it.
"Master,"
he said, handing it to Tripitaka,
"this scroll has got no writing on it."
Monkey then opened a scroll. It, too, was blank. Pigsy did the same, only to make the same discovery.
"We had better look at them all," said Tripitaka.
They did so and found that all were blank.
"I must say, it's hard luck on the people of China," sobbed Tripitaka. "What is the use of taking to them these blank books? How shall I dare face the Emperor of Tiang? He will say I am playing a joke on him, and have me executed on the spot."
Monkey had by now guessed what had happened.
"Master,"
he said,
"I know what's at the bottom of this. It is all because we refuse to give Ananda and Kesiapa their commission. This is how they have revenged themselves on us. The only thing to do is to go straight to Buddha and charge them with fraudulent withholding of delivery.
They all agreed and were soon back at the temple gates.
They've come back to change their scriptures, said the bands of the blessed, laughing.
This time they were allowed to go straight in.
Listen to this,
shouted Monkey.
After all the trouble we had getting here from China, and after you specially ordered that we were to be given the scriptures, Ananda and Kesiapa made a fraudulent delivery of goods. They gave us blank copies to take away. I ask you, what is the good of that to us?
You needn't shout, said Buddha, smiling. I quite expected that those two would ask for their commission. As a matter of fact, scriptures ought not to be given on too easy terms or received gratis. On one occasion, some of my monks went down the mountain to Sravasti with some scriptures and let Cheo, the man of substance, read them out loud. The result was that all the live members of his household were protected from all calamity and the dead were saved from perdition. For this, they only charged gold to the weight of 3 pecks and 3 pints of rice. I told them they had sold far too cheap. No wonder they gave you blank copies when they saw that you did not intend to make any payment at all. As a matter of fact, it is such blank scrolls as these that are the true scriptures. But I quite see that the people of China are too foolish and ignorant to believe this. So there is nothing for it but to give them copies with some writing on.
Then he called for Ananda and Kesiapa and told them to choose a few scrolls with writing out of each of the 35 divisions of the scriptures, hand them over to the pilgrims, and then inform him of the exact titles and numbers. The two disciples accordingly took the pilgrims once more to the treasury, where they again asked Tripitaka for a little present. He could think of nothing to give them except his golden begging bowl. He told Sandy to find it, and holding it up before him in both hands, he said to the two disciples,
I am a poor man, and have been travelling for a long time. I fear I have nothing with me that is suitable as a present, but perhaps you would accept this bowl which the Emperor of China gave me with his own hand, that I might use it to beg with on the road. If you will put up with so small a trifle, I am sure that when I return to China and report upon my mission, you may count upon being suitably rewarded. I hope on these terms that you will this time give me scriptures with writing on them, or I fear His Majesty will be disappointed and think that all my efforts have been wasted.
Ananda took the bowl with a faint smile, but all the divinities in attendance, down to the last kitchen boy god, clapped one another on the back and roared with laughter, saying,
Well, of all the shameless! They've made the scripture-seekers pay them a commission.
The two disciples looked somewhat embarrassed, but Ananda continued to clutch tightly at the bowl. Kesiapa, meanwhile, began looking at the scriptures and handing them over to Tripitaka. Disciples, said he, keep a sharp look out to see that the same thing doesn't happen again. 5,048 scrolls were duly handed over. All of them had writing. Then they were properly arranged and loaded on the horse's back, and a few that were over were made into a packet and given to Pigsy to carry. The other luggage was carried by Sandy while Monkey led the horse. Tripitaka carried his priest's staff and wore his jeweled cap and brocaded cassock. In this guise they all once more presented themselves before Buddha. Seated on his lotus throne, the Blessed One ordered the two great arhats to beat on their cloud gongs and summon to the throne the 3,000 Buddhas, the 8 Vajrapanis, the 4 Bodhisattvas, the 500 arhats, the 800 monks, and all the congregation of the faithful. Those that were entitled to be seated were ordered to sit upon their jeweled thrones, and those that were to stand were ranged in 2 files on either hand. Soon heavenly music was heard from afar. A magic radiance filled the air. When the whole company was duly assembled, Buddha asked his two disciples for an exact account of the scriptures that they'd handed over. Ananda and Kesiapa then read over the list, beginning with the Book of the Great Decease and ending with the Kosa Sastra.
"These books," said Ananda, "written on 5,048 scrolls, have all been given to the priests of China to keep forever in their land. They are now all securely packed on their horses' back or in parcels to be carried by hand, and the pilgrims are here to thank you."
Tripitaka and the disciples tethered the horse, put down the burdens, and bowed with the palms of their hands pressed together. "The efficacy of these scriptures is boundless," said Buddha. "They are not only the mirror of our faith, but also the source and origin of all three religions. When you return to the world and show them to common mortals, they must not be lightly handled. No scroll must be opened save by one who has fasted and bathed. Treasure them,
value them,
for in them is secreted the mystic law of immortality. In them is revealed the wondrous receipt for 10,000 transformations." Tripitaka kowtowed his thanks, doing leal homage and prostrating himself 3 times as he had done before. When they had reached the outer gates, they paid their respects to the bands of the faithful and went on their way. After dismissing the pilgrims, Buddha broke up the assembly. Presently, the bodhisattva Kuan Yin appeared before the throne, saying,
"Long ago I was instructed by you to find someone in China who would come here to fetch scriptures. He has now achieved this task, which has taken him 5,040 days. The number of the scrolls delivered to him is 5,048. I suggest that it would be appropriate if he were given 8 days in which to complete his mission, so that the 2 figures may concord."
"A very good idea," said Buddha. "You may have that put into effect."
He then sent for the 8 Vajrapanis and said to them,
"You are to exert your magic powers and carry back Tripitaka to the east. When he has deposited the scriptures, you are to bring him back here. All this must be done in 8 days, that the number of days taken by the journey may concord with the number of scrolls allotted to him."
The Vajrapanis at once went after Tripitaka, caught him up, and said to him,
"Scripture taker, follow us. A sudden lightness and agility possessed the pilgrims, and they were borne aloft upon a magic cloud."
And if you do not know how they returned to the east and handed over the scriptures, you must listen to what is told in the next chapter. So the 8 Vajrapanis escorted Tripitaka back to the east. Of this no more shall now be said, but it must be told that the guardians of the 5 points, the sentinels of the 4 watches, and all the divinities who had protected Tripitaka during his journey now appeared before Kuan Yin and said, "Your disciples have faithfully carried out your holy instructions and have all unseen guarded the priest of Tiang in his journey to the west. You have reported to the Lord Buddha on the execution of your task, and we beg to report on our endeavors."
"The presentation of a report is hereby authorized," said the bodhisattva.
"I should like first to know what disposition the pilgrims displayed during their journey."
"They manifested the greatest determination and devotion,"
said the divinities.
"A fact that has doubtless not escaped your inspired perspicacity. The tribulations endured by the pilgrims were indeed too many to be fully enumerated, but I have here a record of the major calamities."
The bodhisattva took the record and examined it with care. "Tripitaka falls into a pit, is attacked by tigers, but saved by his disciple Monkey. He is attacked by the 6 robbers, and so on. right down to his adventure in the boat with no bottom. In our faith, said the Bodhisattva, 9 times 9 is the crucial number. I see that the number of calamities listed here is 80, thus falling short by 1 of the holy number. Then turning to a guardian, she said, catch up the Vajrapanis and tell them that there has got to be 1 more calamity. He flew through the clouds to the east, and in a single day and night he caught up the Vajrapanis and whispered something in their ears.
By order of the Bodhisattva herself,
he said,
let there be no mistake.
The Vajrapanis at once withdrew the magic gale that was carrying the pilgrims through space. Horse, scriptures, and all,
they fell to earth with a bang.
Tripitaka was sorely taken aback to discover himself standing upon solid ground.
Pigsy roared with laughter.
Oh, if ever there was a case of more haste, less speed,
he said.
I call it very considerate,
said Sandy.
No doubt they thought we weren't used to travelling so fast and would like a rest.
Well,
said Monkey,
the proverb says, sit tight for 10 days, and in 1 day you'll shoot 9 rapids.
Will you stop talking nonsense,
said Tripitaka,
and devote your ingenuity to discovering where we are?
I know,
said Sandy, looking about him.
Just listen to that sound of water.
It makes Sandy feel at home,
said Monkey.
If it makes him feel at home, said Pigsy, it must be the river of flowing sands. That's where he belongs.
Not at all, said Sandy. It's the river that flows to heaven.
Disciple, said Tripitaka, go up onto the bank and have a look.
Monkey sprang up and, shading his eyes with his hand, closely inspected the river.
Master,
he reported,
this is the western shore of the river that flows to heaven.
I remember now,
cried Tripitaka.
On the other side is Mr. Chien's farm. When we passed this way, you saved the boy and girl. They were very grateful to us and wanted to make you a boat. In the end, a white turtle took us across. I remember that on this side there are no houses at all. How are we to manage this time?
A dirty trick like this would not surprise one if one were dealing with ordinary people, said Pigsy. But it's a bit too much coming from Buddha's own particular henchman. He told them to take us straight back to the east. What do I mean by dropping us in the middle of the journey? They've left us in a bit of a fix.
I don't know what you two are grumbling about,
said Sandy.
The master is now no longer a common mortal. We saw his earthly body float by us down the cloud river. There's no fear of him sinking this time. With all three of us to assist him, it would be strange if he couldn't get across.
Monkey smiled to himself.
It's not going to be as easy as all that,
he said. Why did he say it was not going to be so easy? If it had been merely a question of possessing sufficient magic powers, all four of them could easily enough have floated across a thousand such rivers. But Monkey knew that the number 9 times 9 was not yet fulfilled, and that Buddha's inexorable will decreed for them yet another calamity. They were all walking slowly along the shore, discussing the situation as they went, when suddenly they heard a voice cry, Priest of Tiang! Priest of Tiang! Come over here! As no one was to be seen in the vicinity, and there was no boat on the river, they were much astonished. But in a moment they caught sight of a large white head. The white turtle was nearing the shore.
I've been waiting for you all this time,
he said, craning his neck.
We're very glad to meet you, said Monkey. Come a little closer in.
The turtle then sidled up to the bank, and Monkey led the horse onto its broad back. Pigsy squatted behind its tail. Tripitaka stood on one side of its head, Sandy on the other. Monkey stood with one foot on its neck and the other on its head.
Now then, old turtle,
he cried.
Go steadily.
And the turtle set off smoothly and easily across the waters, carrying the whole company uneventfully till evening fell, and they had almost reached the far side. Suddenly the turtle said,
When I took you across last time, I asked you to find out from Buddha how long it will be before I attain to human form. Did you remember to ask?
Unfortunately, Tripitaka had been so much taken up with his own affairs, losing his mortal body, going up the holy mountain, meeting Buddha and all the bodhisattvas and the bands of the faithful, taking over the scriptures and so on, that he had had no time to think of anything else and had quite forgotten to ask about the turtle's prospects. Not daring to tell a downright lie, he hemmed and hawed without giving any definite answer. The turtle saw at once that he had not asked, and, much annoyed, dived straight down into the water, leaving the four pilgrims, the horse, and the scriptures floundering in the stream. It was lucky for Tripitaka that he had discarded his mortal frame and achieved the way, otherwise he would have gone straight to the bottom. Fortunately, too, the white horse was really a dragon, and Pigsy and Sandy were both at home in the water. Monkey sprang up, and by a great display of his transcendent powers, bore the master safely to the shore, but the scriptures and all their other belongings got wet through. They had climbed the bank and were getting things straight when a great wind began to blow, the sky became black, lightning flashed, and sand and grit whirled up in their faces. Tripitaka clutched the scripture pack. Sandy clung to his packet while Pigsy hung on to the white horse. Monkey, meanwhile, brandished his cudgel in both hands, now to one side, now to the other. The storm was the outward sign of the invisible demons who were attempting to snatch away the scriptures. Their attacks continued all night, but towards daybreak at last subsided. Tripitaka, soaked to the skin, was trembling from head to foot.
Monkey, what does all this mean?
He asked.
You do not seem to realize the immensity of our task,
said Monkey.
In enabling you to secure these scriptures, we have incurred the envy of every spirit in heaven and earth, for our undying feet trespasses on the domain of their sovereign powers. They have been making every endeavor to snatch from us what we have gained. Had not the scriptures been wet through, and had you not held them with hands no longer mortal, and had not I kept our hidden foes at bay with this short cudgel, the magic gale would have blown them away before dawn came, and the forces of light again prevailed.
Tripitaka and the rest then realized what had been afoot, and thanked Monkey for his protection. When the sun was well up, they carried the scriptures on to a flat place above the bank and spread them out to dry. Till now, the place is called the Rock Where Scriptures Were Dried. They also dried their shoes and clothes. They were looking through the scriptures to see if they were all dry, when they saw some fishermen coming along the shore, among whom were some who seemed to recognize them.
Are you not the reverend gentleman who went across the river to fetch scriptures from India?
They said.
That's right, said Pigsy. Where do you come from, and how is it that you recognized us?
We're from Mr. Chen's farm, said the fisherman.
How far off is it?
Asked Pigsy.
If you went about 20 leagues straight south from here, you'd come to it,
they said.
Let's take the scriptures and dry them properly at the farm,
said Pigsy.
There's much to be gained by going there. We can sit down comfortably for a bit, get something to eat, and ask the people there to wring out our clothes.
I'm not going, said Tripitaka. We can dry the scriptures very well here, and then we'll collect them and start off again.
Meanwhile, the fisherman who had started for home happened to meet the younger Mr. Chien.
"Master," they cried out, "the priests who did away with the child sacrifice here have come back." "Where did you see them?"
he asked.
"They are drawing some scrolls on that rock there,"
said the fisherman. Mr. Chien, accompanied by some of his farm labourers, hurried towards the spot, and when he reached them he fell down upon his knees, crying,
"I see that you have got your scriptures and are returning in triumph. I feel rather hurt that instead of coming and visiting us, you should be loitering about here. Pray come home with me at once."
"Wait till our scriptures are dry, and we'll come home with you,"
said Monkey.
"I see that all your clothes, well as your scriptures, are wet,"
said Mr. Chien. "What has been happening to you?" Tripitaka told him of his unfortunate failure to remember the White Turtle's commission, and how this had led to their all being flung into the water. Mr. Chien pressed them very hard to come home with him, and in the end Tripitaka gave in. When they were collecting the scriptures, several scrolls of the Lali Tavistara stuck to the rock, and a piece got torn from the end of the last scroll. That is why the Lali Tavistara, as we have it today, is incomplete, and why there are still traces of writing on the rock where the scriptures were dried. Tripitaka was much upset. "I am afraid that this was very careless of us," he said. "We ought to have gone slower and taken more trouble."
"You have no reason to get into such a state about it,"
said Monkey.
"These scriptures are now just as intact as they were intended to be. Heaven and earth themselves are not more complete. The part now broken off contained a secret refinement of doctrine that was not meant for transmission, and no care on your part could have prevented this accident."
When the scriptures had been collected, they all set out for the farm. The news of their arrival spread with astonishing rapidity, and they were met by everyone in the place, young and old. As soon as he heard of the pilgrims' arrival, the elder, Mr. Chien, ordered an incense stand to be set up and awaited them at the gate. He also ordered music to be made, and to the accompaniment of flutes and drums led them in. He then told the whole household to come one by one and pay their respects to the benefactors who had saved the children from destruction. After this, tea and refreshments were brought in. Tripitaka, since he had discarded his mortal body and became a Buddha, and received magic viands from the Tathagata's table, had evinced little taste for earthly food. It was only at the urgent insistence of the two old men that he was persuaded to make some show of tasting what was put before him. Monkey, who in any case never ate cooked food, soon pushed his plate from him. Sandy, too, ate very little. Even Pigsy did not eat with anything like the zest he had shown the last time they were here.
"Fool,"
said Monkey,
"you are not doing yourself justice."
"I don't know why it is," said Pigsy. "I've been a bit off my feed lately."
The tables were cleared, and Tripitaka told the whole story of their adventures from the time they reached paradise down to the attempts of unseen demons to seize the scriptures. Then he made to go, but the old men would not hear of it.
"We could think of no better way of showing our gratitude,"
they said,
"than by setting up a shrine, which we call the Temple of Deliverance, where we continually burn incense in your honour."
After War Boy and the girl Load of Gold had been sent for and had kowtowed their gratitude, the pilgrims were invited to come and look at the shrine. On the upper floor were four statues representing Tripitaka, Monkey, Pigsy, and Sandy.
"Yours is very like,"
said Pigsy, nudging Monkey.
"I think yours is a wonderful likeness, too,"
said Sandy to Pigsy.
"But the master's really makes him out a little too handsome."
"I think it's very good,"
said Tripitaka. On going down, they found more refreshments waiting for them in one of the cloisters.
"By the way, what has become of the great king's shrine?"
asked Monkey.
"We pulled it down,"
they said.
"But so great is your blessed power and protection that since we built this shrine in your honour, we have had a bumper harvest every year."
"Such blessings come from heaven,"
said Monkey.
"We don't claim to have any hand in it, but we will try henceforth to give you all such protection as we can. Your children and children's children shall be many. Your herds shall give easy birth. The winds and rains shall come in due season."
The people thanked him again, and once more offerings of fruit and cake of every kind came pouring in from all sides.
"It's bad luck on me," said Pigsy. "In the old days, when I really had some appetite, no one thought of pressing victuals on me. But today, when I eat next to nothing, they swarm round me, pressing on one another's heels, and beg me to stuff myself. I suppose I mustn't be rude."
And to spare their feelings, he managed, without undue violence to his inside, to get through 8 or 9 dishes of vegetables and 20 or 30 pasties. They were still egging him on when Tripitaka said,
"I don't know how you have managed to make yourself so popular. I think it will be better to call a halt for the present. Your friends can continue their attentions tomorrow morning."
It was now late in the night. Tripitaka did not dare leave the scriptures for a minute and mounted watch over them in the lower part of the shrine. Just before the third watch, he whispered,
"Monkey, the people here know that we have mastered the secrets of the way. It is said the adept does not reveal himself. If he reveals himself, he is not an adept. I am afraid that if we stay here too long, our secrets may be wormed out of us."
"I agree with you,"
said Monkey.
"We had better creep away quickly while it is still night and everyone is asleep."
Pigsy was no longer a fool. Sandy had attained to perfect discretion, and the white horse was well able to see the point of an argument. So they all got up and prepared to start. When they got to the main gate of the shrine, they found it locked. But Monkey used a lock-breaking magic, and they were soon through the double gates and seeking the road to the east. Suddenly came the voices of the 8 Vajrapanis crying from up above in the air,
"Now then, where are you off to? Follow us!"
Tripitaka smelt a great gust of perfumed wind, which caught him up and bore him up into the air.
And if you want to know how he met the king of Tiang, you must listen to what is told in the next chapter. When day came, the people again began to pour in with offerings of fruit and other dainties. To their astonishment, the pilgrims had vanished.
After hunting high and low till they could think of nowhere else to look, they gave up all hope and cried to the joiner of days, "Fie upon you, limpid one! Why have you taken our living Buddha away?"
There was nothing for it but to lay the viands they had brought upon the altar of the shrine, where they burned paper slips and prayed for the acceptance of the offerings. Ever afterwards, 4 times a year, they performed a grand ceremony, and twice a month a lesser ceremony at this shrine. And apart from this, at every hour of every day, there would always be worshippers there praying for recovery from illness or protection on a journey, praying for chattels or children. Meanwhile, it took less than a day for this second gale of magic wind to blow the pilgrims back to China, and soon they began to see the towers of Chiang'an. It was 3 days before the full moon of the 9th month in the 13th year of the period Qianquan that the emperor escorted Tripitaka to the outskirts of the city. In the 16th year, he ordered a pagoda to be built outside the western gates called the Scripture Lookout Tower, and every year he visited it in person. It so happened that he was visiting the pagoda on the day when the pilgrims arrived. Looking out,
he suddenly saw the whole western sky fill with a magic radiance. A moment later, he noticed a strange perfume in the breeze. "Well, here we are at Chiang'an," cried the 8 Vajrapanis, coming to a halt in mid-air. "We would rather not alight, as the people in these parts are very tricky, and if they caught sight of us, might make our presence known in undesirable quarters. There is also no reason for the 3 disciples to go down, but you, Master, had better go at once and hand over the scriptures and then come back here. We'll wait for you in mid-air, and then we will all go back and report in paradise."
"That's all very well," said Monkey.
"But how is the master to carry the scriptures, and who is to lead his horse? We had much better go with him while you wait here. You may be sure we shan't get in his way."
"The Bodhisattva promised Buddha that the whole business should take only 8 days,"
said the Vajrapanis.
"If you all go, we shall have Pigsy touting round for offerings and get behind time."
"You lazy old ruffians," cried Pigsy. "Why should you think I shall waste time touting round here? I am as anxious as anyone to get back to paradise. The master has become a Buddha, and I intend to become a Buddha too. You wait here, and the minute we have handed in the scriptures, I'll come back with you and be canonized."
So Pigsy, carrying the pack, Sandy leading the horse, and Monkey accompanying Tripitaka, they alighted at the side of the pagoda. The emperor and his ministers at once came down to meet them. "So my dear brother has come at last," he cried. Tripitaka bowed low.
"And who are these?"
asked the emperor.
"They are disciples I picked up on the road," said Tripitaka.
"Saddle one of my chariot horses," said the emperor to his servants, "and my brother shall ride back with me to the court." By the time they reached Chiang'an, there was not a soul in the city who had not heard that the scripture-seekers had arrived. It was noticed by the priests in Tripitaka's old temple that a pine tree in the courtyard was bent towards the east.
"This is very strange," they said. "There was no wind to speak of in the night. How comes it that the top of this tree is bent down?"
Among them was one of Tripitaka's old disciples.
"Go and get your cloaks at once," he cried. "The master has come home with the scriptures."
"How do you know?"
they asked.
"He told us when he went away,"
said he,
"that he might be absent for 3, 5, or even 7 years, but that if we saw the top of this pine tree bent towards the east, it would mean that he was coming back. Sooner would Buddha himself speak falsely than a lie escape my master's lips. I know that he is here."
The priests hurriedly put on their cloaks and went out. They had not gone very far before someone called to them,
"Have you heard the news? The scripture-seekers have just arrived, and the emperor himself met them and brought them back into the city."
Hearing this, they hurried faster than ever and were just in time to meet the procession. They dared not approach too close, but followed the imperial party till it reached the gates of the palace. When the pilgrims reached the audience hall, the emperor seated Tripitaka by his side and ordered the scriptures to be brought in. Monkey and the rest delivered them to the chamberlains, who in turn laid them before the emperor.
"How many scrolls are there?"
he asked.
"And how were they given to you?"
Tripitaka described his arrival at the holy mountain, the trick played by Ananda and Kesyapa, and how he had in the end obtained written copies by parting with the begging bowl given to him by His Majesty.
"As to the number of scrolls,"
he said,
"there are 5,048, some chosen from each of the 35 sections."
The emperor was delighted and ordered the entertainment board to prepare a banquet of welcome in the eastern tower. Suddenly his eye fell on the 3 disciples who were waiting at the far end of the hall. Their appearance struck him as very unusual.
"I suppose these gentlemen are foreigners,"
he said.
"My eldest disciple, named Monkey,"
said Tripitaka,
comes from the Water Curtain Cave on the Mountain of Flowers and Fruit. 500 years ago, he made trouble in heaven, and Buddha imprisoned him in a stone chest under the Mountain of the Two Frontiers. But he was converted by the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin, and on my way to India I was able to release him and take him with me as my disciple. His protection stood me in good stead, and had it not been for him, I could never have fulfilled my mission. My second disciple, Pigsy, came from the Cloud Ladder Cave on Mount Fu Ling. He was haunting Mr. Keo's farm when I came that way and picked him up. He has carried the luggage throughout our journey and also proved very useful when rivers had to be crossed. My third disciple, Sandy, comes from the River of Flowing Sands. He, too, was converted by Kuan Yin and was received into the order. The horse is not the one that you bestowed upon me.
Indeed, said the emperor. Its coat looks very similar.
How came you to change horses? When we were crossing the Falcon Grief Torrent, said Tripitaka, the original horse was swallowed by this one. But Monkey went to Kuan Yin and inquired about the origins of this horse. It appears that it was a son of the Dragon King of the Western Ocean, but got into trouble and would have been executed had not the Bodhisattva intervened and appointed it to be my steed. It was then that it changed into a horse with a coat exactly like that of my original mount. It has carried me faithfully over the most difficult crags and passes. On the way there, I rode on its back. On the way home, it carried the scriptures, so that in one way and another, we are much beholden to it.
You have been very well served, said the emperor.
It would interest me to know exactly how far it is to India. I remember,
said Tripitaka,
that the Bodhisattva spoke of the distance as being 108,000 leagues. We kept no exact count, but I know that summer turned to winter 14 times, and that there was no day upon which we did not cross some range of hills. Often we had to make our way through vast forests or across huge rivers. As for the kingdoms through which we passed, you will find the seals of each one of them stamped upon our passports.
Then he called to his disciples to bring the passports for the emperor's inspection. Seeing that they were marked as having been issued 3 days before the full moon of the 9th month of the 13th year of Chieng Quan, the emperor smiled.
It has been a long job, he said. It is now the 27th year.
Then he looked at the seals. There was the seal of the country of Kro Kok, the seal of the Cart Slow country, and many others, and finally the seal of the Golden Treasury of Paradise. Having examined the passports, he handed them back. Just then, an official announced that the banquet was ready, and taking Tripitaka by the hand, the emperor led him down the hall.
Are your disciples familiar with court etiquette?
He asked.
I'm afraid not, said Tripitaka. They have spent their time in uncouth and deeply rural surroundings. I fear they have no inkling of what the etiquette of the Chinese court demands. I must ask your majesty to be lenient towards them.
Don't worry, said the emperor.
I shan't blame them. Tell them all to come along to the banquet.
The pilgrims find themselves, along with all the officials, civil and military, grouped on either side of the imperial seat. There was dancing and singing and the music of lutes and drums. The whole entertainment was on the most magnificent scale, and it was indeed a happy day. When evening came, the guests expressed their thanks and withdrew. The emperor betook him to the women's apartments, and the officials to their residences. The pilgrims went to Tripitaka's old temple, where they were welcomed by the kowtowing priests.
Master,
they said,
this tree this morning suddenly bent towards the east. We remembered what you told us and went out to meet you.
Inside the temple, Pigsy did not shout for food or create any disturbance. Monkey and Sandy behaved with perfect decorum, for all three were now illumined, and it cost them no pains to stay quiet. When night came, they all went to sleep. Early next morning, the emperor said to his ministers at court,
"All night long I could not sleep, so full were my thoughts of the magnitude of my brother's achievements and the impossibility of making any adequate recompense. I ended by composing in my head a few clumsy sentences which I hope may make him aware of my gratitude. I have not yet written them down."
Then he called for one of the imperial secretaries and said,
"I want to dictate something to you. Please take it down very accurately."
What the emperor dictated is known to all, for it was the introduction to Buddha's holy teachings, which still figures in the canon. When he had finished dictating, he sent for Tripitaka.
"Your Majesty's style," said Tripitaka, "is very lofty and archaic, and your reasoning is subtle and profound. I notice, however, that there is no title at the head of your essay."
"I made it up in my head during the night as a token of gratitude to my reverend brother," said the emperor.
"How would it be if I called it Introduction to Buddha's Holy Teachings?"
Tripitaka kowtowed his assent. "My talent," the emperor continued, "pales before the wisdom that is inscribed on tablets of jade. My words are put to shame by the maxims that are incised on bronze and stone. As to the esoteric texts, my ignorance of them is, alas, profound. This, remember, is an essay composed in my head, and necessarily rough and clumsy. It is, I fear, not worth your notice, and you have no need to thank me." The officials who were present all congratulated the emperor on the felicity of his improvised composition and recommended that it should be circulated everywhere, both at court and beyond.
"Won't you read to us out of the scriptures?" said the emperor to Tripitaka. "Your Majesty," said he, "this is no place to recite holy writ. The scriptures may only be read in a place dedicated to religion."
"Which is the holiest of all the shrines in Chiang'an?" the emperor asked, turning to those about him. "Holiest of all is the Wild Goose Pagoda," said the grand preceptor, He Xiao Yi.
"Take a few chapters from each of the main scriptures," said the emperor, "and reverently transport them to the Wild Goose Pagoda.
Then we'll get my holy brother to read them out to us." The selection was made, and they all went off to the pagoda, where a platform was erected and everything made ready for the recitation. Tripitaka told Pigsy and Sandy to hold the dragon horse and mind the baggage, and Monkey to be ready to hand the scrolls to him.
"Your Majesty," remarked Tripitaka, "will have to have copies of these scriptures made if you want to promulgate them throughout your empire. The originals are far too precious to be bandied about."
"That's perfectly true," said the emperor, and he gave orders that scribes of the Han Lin Academy should make copies of the scriptures. These were distributed through a special agency set up to the east of the city called the Temple of Transcription. Tripitaka had already gone up onto the platform with a number of scrolls and was just going to begin his recitation
when the familiar gust of perfumed wind reached his nostrils and the 8 Vajrapanis appeared in mid-air saying, "Recitants, leave your scriptures and follow us to the west."
Immediately Monkey and the others, including the white horse, began to rise from the ground. Tripitaka laid down his scroll and rose above the platform, straight up into the 9th heaven.
In utter amazement, the emperor and his ministers did homage to them as they receded. Soon afterwards, a great mass was held at the Wild Goose Pagoda. The true scriptures of the great vehicle were for the first time seen and recited, and multitudes of lost souls were saved from darkness.
Moreover, through the labours of the Temple of Transcription, their blessing became universal. Meanwhile, the four pilgrims and the white horse were carried back to paradise by the 8 Vajrapanis, and counting up the time taken by their going and coming, it proved that the whole journey had barely taken the 8 stipulated days. It happened that when they arrived, all the deities of the holy mountain were assembled before Buddha to receive his instructions. We beg to state that the pilgrims have been to Chiang'an, as commanded, have handed over the scriptures, and have now returned to report, said the Vajrapanis. They then motioned to Tripitaka and the rest to come forward and receive their heavenly rank. Holy priest, said the Theragata, you in a previous existence were my second disciple and were called Golden Cicada. But because you paid no heed to my teaching and scoffed at my doctrine, I caused you to be reborn in the East. But now, by the true devotion you have shown in the fetching of my holy scriptures, you have won great merit, and I herewith appoint you to be a Buddha, with the title Buddha of Precocious Merit. Manke, because you made trouble in heaven, it was found necessary to imprison you under the mountain of the 5 elements. But fortunately, when the time of your retribution was ended, you turned your heart to the great faith, and your endeavour to the scourging of evil and the promotion of good. Upon your return journey, you distinguished yourself by the subjugation of monsters and demons, and have done first and last so well that I hereby promote you to be the Buddha victorious in strife. Pigsy, you were once a marshal of the watery hosts of heaven, but at a peach banquet you drank too much and made free with a fairy maiden. For this you were condemned to be born into the common world with a shape near to animal. However, when you were haunting the cave of the cloud ladder, you were converted to the higher religion, eventually became a priest and gave your protection to Tripitaka on his journey. Greed and lust are not yet utterly extinct in you, but remembering that you carried the luggage all the way, I now promote you to be cleanser of the altar.
Hey, what's this? I don't understand, said Pigsy. You've just made the other two into Buddhas. Why aren't I a Buddha too?
Because, said Buddha, your conversation and appearance still lack refinement, and your appetite is still too large. But the number of my worshippers in all the 4 continents of the universe is very large, and it will be your job to clean up the altars everywhere, and whenever there is a Buddhist ceremony and offerings are made. So you'll get plenty of pickings. I don't see what you've got to complain of. Sandy, you were a captain of spirits, but one day at the peach banquet you broke a crystal dish and were banished to the common world, where you settled in the river of flowing sands and lived by devouring human flesh. Fortunately, you were converted, zealously and faithfully carried out your vows and protected Tripitaka. In recognition of the way you got his horse over the mountain passes, I now promote you to the rank of an Arhat, with the title Golden-Bodied Arhat. Then he turned to the white horse. You, he said, were a child of the Dragon King of the Western Ocean, but you disobeyed your father and were found guilty of unfilial conduct. Fortunately, you were converted to the faith and became attached to our order. Because you carried Tripitaka to the west and on the return journey transported the scriptures, your services too must be rewarded, and I hereby promote you to be one of the 8 senior heavenly dragons. The 4 pilgrims all kowtowed their thanks, and the white horse also made sign of its gratitude. Then, by Buddha's order, it was led to the back of the holy mountain, to the side of the pool of magic dragons, into the middle of which it was pushed with a splash. After a short while, it began to stretch itself, and its coat began to change in appearance. It grew horns upon its head, and its body became covered with golden scales, while on its cheeks
silver whiskers grew. Its whole form was suffused with magic tints. Its four claws rested on prophetic clouds. It soared up out of the pool, wreathed its way in at the gate of the palace, and circled above the pillar that supports heaven. All the Buddhas burst into exclamations of wonder at this miracle that the Tathagata had wrought. "Master," Monkey said to Tripitaka, "I'm now a Buddha, the same as you. It's not fair that I should still wear this golden fillet, so that if you choose to recite your spell, you could still plague me. Make haste and say the loosing of the fillet spell, so that I may get it off and smash it to bits. Otherwise, the Bodhisattva may use it to play her jokes on anyone else."
"It was put upon you," said Tripitaka, "at a time when you needed to be kept in hand. Now that you are a Buddha, it has vanished of its own accord. Feel your head and you'll see."
Monkey put his hand to his head. What Tripitaka had said was quite true. The fillet was not there. The promotion of the five saints took place in the presence of all the spirits of heaven, Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, Arhats, monks, local deities, and the guardian spirits. While the newcomers took their appointed places in the assembly, multitudinous voices rose in prayer, praise to the Buddha of the past, praise to the Vaisharsha, praise to Sakyamuni, and so on through all the Buddhas, till finally for the first time they chanted, praise to the Buddha of precocious merit, praise to the Buddha victorious in strife. Next, they invoked the names of all the Bodhisattvas, Kuan Yin, Mahastam Prapta, Manjusri, Samant Abhadra, and the rest, ending with, praise to the cleanser of the altar, praise to the golden-bodied Arhat, praise to the heavenly dragon. I dedicate this work to the glory of Buddha's pure land. May it repay the kindness of patron and preceptor. May it mitigate the sufferings of the lost and damned. May all that read it or hear it read find their hearts turned towards truth. In the end be born again in the realms of utter bliss, and by their common intercession requite me for the ardours of my task.